Subsequently, after 1917, by a transfer of meaning, the name Kulak began to be applied, in official and propaganda literature, whence it moved into general usage, to all those who in any way hired workers, even if it was only when they were temporarily short of working hands in their own families. But we must keep in mind that after the revolution it was impossible to pay less than a fair wage for all such labour. The committees of the poor and the village Soviets looked after the interests of landless labourers. Just let somebody try to swindle a landless labourer. To this very day, in fact, the hiring of labour at a fair wage is permitted in the Soviet Union. But the inflation of this scathing term, kulak, proceeded relentlessly, and by 1930 all strong peasants in general were being so called, all peasants strong in management, strong in work, or even strong merely in convictions. The term kulak was used to smash the strength of the peasantry. Let us remember, let us open our eyes. Only a dozen years had passed since the great decree on the land, that very decree without which the peasants would have refused to follow the Bolsheviks and without which the October Revolution would have failed. The land was allocated in accordance with the number of mouths per family, equally. It had been only 9 years since the men of the peasantry had returned from the Red Army and rushed onto the land they had wrested for themselves. Then, suddenly, there were kulaks, and there were poor peasants. How could that be? Sometimes it was the result of differences in initial stock and equipment. Sometimes it may have resulted from luck in the mixture of the family. But wasn't it most often a matter of hard work and persistence? And now these peasants, whose bread grain had fed Russia in 1928, were hastily uprooted by local good-for-nothings and city people sent in from outside. Like raging beasts, abandoning every concept of humanity, abandoning all humane principles which had evolved through the millennia, they began to round up the very best farmers and their families and to drive them, stripped of their possessions, naked into the northern wastes, into the tundra and the taiga. Such a mass movement could not help but develop subsequent ramifications. It became necessary to rid the villages also of those peasants who had merely manifested an aversion to joining the collective farms, or an absence of inclination for the collective life which they had never seen with their own eyes, about which they knew nothing, and which they suspected, we know now how well-founded their suspicions were, would mean a life of forced labour and famine under the leadership of loafers. Then it was also necessary to get rid of those peasants, some of them not at all prosperous, who, because of their daring, their physical strength, their determination, their outspokenness at meetings, and their love of justice, were favourites with their fellow villagers, and by virtue of their independence were therefore dangerous to the leadership of the collective farm. This kind of peasant and his fate were portrayed immortally in the character of Stepan Trousoff in S. Zalikin's novel. Beyond this, in every village there were people who in one way or another had personally gotten in the way of the local activists. This was the perfect time to settle accounts with them of jealousy, envy, insult. A new word was needed for all these new victims as a class, and it was born. By this time it had no social or economic content whatsoever, but had a marvellous sound, podkulachnik, a person aiding the kulaks. In other words, I consider you an accomplice of the enemy, and that finishes you. The most tattered, landless labourer in the countryside could quite easily be labelled a podkulachnik. I remember very well that in our youth this term seemed quite logical. There was nothing in the least unclear about it. And so it was that these two terms embraced everything that constituted the essence of the village, its energy, its keenness of wit, its love of hard work, its resistance, and its conscience. They were torn up by the roots, and collectivization was accomplished. But new waves rolled from the collectivized villages. One of them was a wave of agricultural wreckers. Everywhere they began to discover wrecker agronomists, who up until that year had worked honestly all their lives, but who now purposely sowed weeds in Russian fields, on the instructions, of course, of the Moscow Institute, which had now been totally exposed, Indeed, there were those same 200,000 unarrested members of the Working Peasants' Party, the TKP. Certain agronomists failed to put into effect the profound instructions of Lysenko, and in one such wave in 1931, Lork, the so-called king of the potato, was sent to Kazakhstan. Others carried out the Lysenko directives too precisely, and thus exposed their absurdity. In 1934, Pskov agronomists sowed flax on the snow, exactly as Lysenko had ordered. The seeds swelled up, grew mouldy, and died. The big fields lay empty for a year. Lysenko could not say that the snow was a kulak, or that he himself was an ass. He accused the agronomists of being kulaks and of distorting his technology. And the agronomists went off to Siberia. Beyond all this, in almost every machine and tractor station, wrecking in the repairing of tractors was discovered, and that is how the failures of the first collective farm years were explained. There was a wave for harvest losses, losses in comparison with the arbitrary harvest figures announced the preceding spring by the Commission for Determination of the Harvest. There was a wave for failure to fulfill obligations undertaken for delivery to the state of bread grains. The district party committee had undertaken the obligation, and the collective farm had not fulfilled it. Go to prison. There was a wave for snipping ears, the night-time snipping of individual ears of grain in the field, a totally new type of agricultural activity, a new type of harvesting. The wave of those caught doing this was not small. It included many tens of thousands of peasants, many of them not even adults, but boys, girls, and small children whose elders had sent them out at night to snip, because they had no hope of receiving anything from the collective farm for their daytime labour. For this bitter and not very productive occupation, an extreme of poverty to which the peasants had not been driven even in serfdom, the courts handed out a full measure, 10 years, for what ranked as an especially dangerous theft of socialist property under the notorious law of August 7, 1932, which, in prisoners' lingo, was known simply as the Law of Seven-Eighths. This Law of Seven-Eighths produced another big separate wave from the construction project of the first and second five-year plans, from transport, trade, and industry. Big thefts were turned over to the NKVD. This wave must further be kept in mind as one that kept on flowing steadily for the next 15 years, until 1947, especially during the war years. Then, in 1947, the original law was expanded and made more harsh. Now, at last, we can catch our breath. Now, at last, all the mass waves are coming to an end. Comrade Molotov said on May the 17th, 1933, "We do not see our task as being mass repressions." Phew! At last! Begone, nighttime fears! But what's that dog howling out there? Go get 'em! Go get 'em! And here we are. The Kirov wave from Leningrad has begun. While it lasted, the tension was acknowledged to be so great that special staffs of the NKVD were set up in each and every district executive committee of the city, and an accelerated judicial procedure was introduced. Even earlier, it had not been famous for being slow, and there was no right of appeal. There had been no appeal earlier. It is also believed that one quarter of Leningrad was purged, cleaned out, in 1934 to 1935. Let this estimate be disproved by those who have the exact statistics and are willing to publish them. To be sure, this wave took in much more than Leningrad alone. It had a substantial impact on the rest of the country in a form that was consistent, though chaotic. The firing from the civil service of all those still left there, whose fathers had been priests, all former noble women, and all persons having relatives abroad. Among such lashing waves as this, certain modest, changeless wavelets always got lost. They were little heard of, but they, too, kept flowing on and on. There were Schutzbündlers, who had lost the class battles in Vienna and had come to the fatherland of the world proletariat for refuge. There were Esperantists, a harmful group which Stalin undertook to smoke out during the years when Hitler was doing the same thing. There were the unliquidated remnants of the Free Philosophic Society, illegal philosophical circles. There were teachers who disagreed with the advanced laboratory team system of instruction. In 1933, for instance, Natalia Ivanovna Bogayenko was arrested by the Rostov GPU, but in the third month of her interrogation, a government decree suddenly announced that the system was a faulty one, and she was let go. There were employees of the political Red Cross, which, through the efforts of Yekaterina Peshkova, was still defending its existence. There were mountain tribes of the North Caucasus who were arrested for their 1935 revolt, and non-Russian nationalities kept rolling in from one area, then another. On the Volga Canal, construction site newspapers were published in four national languages, Tatar, Turkish, Uzbek, and Kazakh. And, of course, there were readers to read them. There were once again believers who this time were unwilling to work on Sundays. They had introduced the 5- and 6-day week. And there were collective farmers sent up for sabotage because they refused to work on religious feast days, as had been their custom in the era of individual farms. And always there were those who refused to become NKVD informers. Among them were priests who refused to violate the secrecy of the confessional, for the organs had very quickly discovered how useful it was to learn the content of confessions, the only use they found for religion. And members of non-Orthodox sects were arrested on an ever wider scale. And the big solitaire game with the socialists went on and on. And last of all, there was a category I have not yet named, a wave that was continually flowing. Section 10, also known as KRA, Counter-Revolutionary Agitation, and also known as ASA, Anti-Soviet Agitation. The wave of Section 10 was perhaps the most constant of all. It never stopped. And whenever there was another big wave, as for instance in 1937, 1945, and 1949, its waters became particularly swollen. This particular unremitting wave grabbed up anyone at all at any moment, but when it came to outstanding intellectuals in the 30s, they sometimes considered it cleverer to fabricate a case based on some conspicuously shameful violation, like pederasty, or in the case of Professor Pletnev, the allegation that, left alone with a woman patient, he bit her breast. A national newspaper reports such an incident, and just try to deny it. Paradoxically enough, every act of the all-penetrating, eternally wakeful organs, over a span of many years, was based solely on one article of the 140 articles of the Non-General Division of the Criminal Code of 1926. One can find more epithets in praise of this article than Turgenev once assembled to praise the Russian language, or Nekrasov to praise Mother Russia. Great, powerful, abundant, highly ramified, multiform, wide-sweeping 58, which summed up the world not so much through the exact terms of its sections as in their extended dialectical interpretation. Who among us has not experienced its all-encompassing embrace? In all truth, there is no step, thought, action, or lack of action under the heavens which could not be punished by the heavy hand of Article 58. The article itself could not be worded in such broad terms, but it proved possible to interpret it this broadly. Article 58 was not in that division of the code dealing with political crimes, and nowhere was it categorized as political. No, it was included, with crimes against public order and organized gangsterism, in a division of crimes against the state. Thus the criminal code starts off by refusing to recognize anyone under its jurisdiction as a political offender. All are simply criminals. Article 58 consisted of 14 sections. In Section 1 we learn that any action, and according to Article 6 of the criminal code, any absence of action, directed toward the weakening of state power, was considered to be counter-revolutionary. Broadly interpreted, this turned out to include the refusal of a prisoner in camp to work when in a state of starvation and exhaustion. This was a weakening of state power, and it was punished by execution. The execution of malingerers during the war. From 1934 on, when we were given back the term motherland, subsections were inserted on treason to the motherland, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D. According to these subsections, all actions directed against the military might of the USSR were punishable by execution, 1B, or by 10 years imprisonment, 1A. But the lighter penalty was imposed only when mitigating circumstances were present, and upon civilians only. Broadly interpreted, when our soldiers were sentenced to only 10 years for allowing themselves to be taken prisoner, action injurious to Soviet military might, this was humanitarian to the point of being illegal. According to the Stalinist code, they should all have been shot on their return home. Here is another example of broad interpretation. I remember well an encounter in the Butyrki in the summer of 1946. A certain Pole had been born in Lemberg when that city was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Until World War II, he lived in his native city, by then located in Poland. Then he went to Austria, where he entered the service, and in 1945 he was arrested there by the Russians. Since by this time Austrian Lemberg had become Ukrainian Lvov, he received a tenor under Article 54(1A) of the Ukrainian Criminal Code, that is, for treason to his motherland, the Ukraine. And at his interrogation, the poor fellow couldn't prove that treason to the Ukraine had not been his purpose when he went to Vienna. And that's how he conned his way into becoming a traitor. One important additional broadening of the section on treason was its application via Article 19 of the Criminal Code, via intent. In other words, no treason had taken place, but the interrogator envisioned an intention to betray, and that was enough to justify a full term, the same as for actual treason. True, Article 19 proposes that there be no penalty for intent, but only for preparation. But given a dialectical reading, one can understand intention as preparation. And preparation is punished in the same way, that is, with the same penalty as the crime itself, Criminal Code. In general, we draw no distinction between intention and the crime itself, and this is an instance of the superiority of Soviet legislation to bourgeois legislation. A.Y. Vyshinsky, editor, From Prisons to Rehabilitative Institutions, a collection of articles published by the Criminal Policy Institute Moscow, Sovetskoye Zakonodetelstvo Publishing House, 1934. Section 2, listed armed rebellion, seizure of power in the capital or in the provinces, especially for the purpose of severing any part of the USSR through the use of force. For this, the penalties ranged up to and included execution, as in every succeeding section. This was expanded to mean something which could not be explicitly stated in the article itself, but which revolutionary sense of justice could be counted on to suggest. It applied to every attempt of any national republic to act upon its right to leave the USSR. After all, the word force is not defined in terms of whom it applies to. Even when the entire population of a republic wants to secede, if Moscow is opposed, the attempted secession will be forcible. Thus, all Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian, Ukrainian, and Turkestan nationalists very easily received their tens and their 25s under this section. Section 3 was assisting in any way or by any means a foreign state at war with the USSR. This section made it possible to condemn any citizen who had been in occupied territory, whether he had nailed on the heel of a German soldier's shoe or sold him a bunch of radishes. And it could be applied to any citizeness who had helped lift the fighting spirit of an enemy soldier by dancing and spending the night with him. Not everyone was actually sentenced under this section because of the huge numbers who had been in occupied territory. But everyone who had been in occupied territory could have been sentenced under it. Section 4 spoke about fantastic aid to the international bourgeoisie. To whom, one wonders, could this possibly refer? And yet, broadly interpreted, and with the help of a revolutionary conscience, it was easy to find categories, all émigrés who had left the country before 1920, that is, several years before the code was ever written, and whom our armies came upon in Europe a quarter century later, in 1944 and 1945, received 58-4, 10 years or execution. What could they have been doing abroad other than aiding the international bourgeoisie? In the example of the Young People's Musical Society already cited, we have seen that the international bourgeoisie could also be aided from inside the USSR. They were, in addition, aided by all SRs, or Mensheviks, the section was drafted with them in mind, and subsequently by the engineers of the State Planning Commission and the Supreme Council of the Economy. Section 5 was inciting a foreign state to declare war against the USSR. A chance was missed to apply this section against Stalin and his diplomatic and military circle in 1940 to 1941. Their blindness and insanity led to just that. Who, if not they, drove Russia into shameful, unheard-of defeats, incomparably worse than the defeats of Tsarist Russia in 1904 or 1915? Defeats such as Russia had never known since the 13th century. Section 6 was espionage. This section was interpreted so broadly that if one were to count up all those sentenced under it, one might conclude that during Stalin's time our people supported life not by agriculture or industry, but only by espionage on behalf of foreigners, and by living on subsidies from foreign intelligence services. Espionage was very convenient in its simplicity, comprehensible both to an undeveloped criminal and to a learned jurist, to a journalist and to public opinion. And very likely spy mania was not merely the narrow-minded predilection of Stalin alone. It was very useful for everyone who possessed any privileges. It became the natural justification for increasingly widespread secrecy, the withholding of information, closed doors and security passes, fenced-off dashas and secret, restricted special shops. People had no way of penetrating the armor plate of spy mania, and learning how the bureaucracy made its cozy arrangements, loafed, blundered, ate, and took its amusements. The breadth of interpretation of Section 6 lay further in the fact that people were sentenced not only for actual espionage, but also for PSH, suspicion of espionage, or NSH, unproven espionage, for which they gave the whole works. And even SVPSH, contacts leading to suspicion of espionage. In other words, let us say that an acquaintance of your wife had a dress made by the same seamstress, who was, of course, an NKVD agent, used by the wife of a foreign diplomat. These 58-6 PSHs and SVPSHs were sticky sections. They required the strict confinement and incessant supervision of those convicted, for, after all, an intelligence service might reach out its tentacles to its protégé even in a camp. Also, such prisoners could be moved only under convoy, armed escort. In general, all the lettered articles, which were in fact not articles of the code at all, but frightening combinations of capital letters, and we shall encounter more of them in this chapter, always contained a touch of the enigmatic, always remained incomprehensible, and it wasn't at all clear whether they were offshoots of Article 58 or independent and extremely dangerous. In many camps, prisoners convicted under the provisions of these lettered articles were subjected to restrictions even more stringent than those of the ordinary 58s. Section 7 applied to subversion of industry, transport, trade, and the circulation of money. In the 30s, extensive use was made of this section to catch masses of people under the simplified and widely understood catchword, wrecking. In reality, everything enumerated under Section 7 was very obviously and plainly being subverted daily. So didn't someone have to be guilty of it all? For centuries, the people had built and created, always honorably, always honestly, even for serf owners and nobles. Yet no one, from the days of Rurik on, had ever heard of wrecking. But now, when for the first time all the wealth had come to belong to the people, hundreds of thousands of the best sons of the people inexplicably rushed off to wreck. Section 7 did not provide for wrecking in agriculture, but since it was impossible otherwise to explain rationally how and why the fields were choked with weeds, why harvests were falling off, why machines were breaking down, then dialectic sensitivity brought agriculture too under its sway. Section 8 covered terror. Not that terror from above, for which the Soviet criminal code was supposed to provide a foundation and basis in legality, but terrorism from below. Terror was construed in a very broad sense, not simply a matter of putting bombs under governors' carriages, but, for example, smashing in the face of a personal enemy, if he was an activist in the party, the Komsomol, or the police. That was already terror. The murder of an activist, especially, was always treated more seriously than the murder of an ordinary person, as in the Code of Hammurabi in the 18th century BC. If a husband killed his wife's lover, it was very fortunate for him if the victim turned out not to be a party member. He would be sentenced under Article 136 as a common criminal, who was a social ally and didn't require an armed escort. But if the lover turned out to have been a party member, the husband became an enemy of the people, with a 58-8 sentence. An even more important extension of the concept was attained by interpreting Section 8 in terms of that same Article 19, that is, intent in the sense of preparation, to include not only a direct threat against an activist uttered near a beer hall, "Just you wait," but also the quick-tempered retort of a peasant woman at the market, "Oh, drop dead." Both qualified as TN, terrorist intent, and provided a basis for applying the article in all its severity. This sounds like an exaggeration, a farce, but it was not I who invented that farce. I was in prison with these individuals. Section 9 concerned destruction or damage by explosion or arson, always with a counter-revolutionary purpose, for which the abbreviated term was diversion, in other words, sabotage. The expansion of this section was based on the fact that the counter-revolutionary purpose could be discerned by the interrogator, who knew best what was going on in the criminal's mind, and every human error, failure, mistake at work or in the production process remained unforgiven and was therefore considered to be a case of diversion. But there was no section in Article 58 which was interpreted as broadly and with so ardent a revolutionary conscience as Section 10. Its definition was propaganda or agitation containing an appeal for the overthrow, subverting or weakening of the Soviet power, and equally the dissemination or preparation or possession of literary materials of similar content. For this section in peacetime, a minimum penalty only was set, not any less, not too light. No upper limit was set for the maximum penalty. Such was the fearlessness of the great power when confronted by the word of a subject. The famous extensions of this famous section were as follows. The scope of agitation containing an appeal was enlarged to include a face-to-face conversation between friends or even between husband and wife, or a private letter. The word appeal could mean personal advice, and we say could mean, because in fact it did. Subverting and weakening the government could include any idea which did not coincide with or rise to the level of intensity of the ideas expressed in the newspaper on any particular day. After all, anything which does not strengthen must weaken. Indeed, anything which does not completely fit in, coincide, subverts. And he who sings not with us today is against us. Mayakovsky. The term preparation of literary materials covered every letter, note, or private diary, even when only the original document existed. Thus, happily expanded, what thought was there whether merely in the mind, spoken aloud, or jotted down, which was not covered by Section 10. Section 11 was a special one. It had no independent content of its own, but provided for an aggravating factor in any of the preceding ones, if the action was undertaken by an organization or if the criminal joined an organization. In actual practice, the section was so broadened that no organization whatever was required. I myself experienced the subtle application of this section. Two of us had secretly exchanged thoughts. In other words, we were the beginnings of an organization. In other words, an organization. Section 12 concerned itself closely with the conscience of our citizens. It dealt with the failure to make a denunciation of any action of the types listed, and the penalty for the mortal sin of failure to make a denunciation carried no maximum limit. This section was in itself such a fantastic extension of everything else that no further extension was needed. "He knew and he did not tell" became the equivalent of "he did it himself." Section 13, presumably long since out of date, had to do with service in the Tsarist secret police, the Okhrana. There are psychological bases for suspecting I, Stalin, of having been liable under this section of Article 58 also. By no means all the documents relating to this type of service survived February 1917 to become matters of public knowledge. V. F. Junkovsky, a former Tsarist police director who died in the Kolyma, declared that the hasty burning of police archives in the first days of the February Revolution was a joint effort on the part of certain self-interested revolutionaries. A subsequent form of analogous service was, on the contrary, considered patriotic. Section 14 stipulated the penalties for conscious failure to carry out defined duties or intentionally careless execution of same. In brief, this was called sabotage or economic counter-revolution, and the penalties, of course, included execution. It was only the interrogator who, after consulting his revolutionary sense of justice, could separate what was intentional from what was unintentional. This section was applied to peasants who failed to come across with food deliveries. It was also applied to collective farmers who failed to work the required minimum number of labor days, to camp prisoners who failed to complete their work norms, and, in a peculiar ricochet, after the war it came to be applied to members of Russia's organized underworld of thieves, the Blatnye, or Blatari, for escaping from camp. In other words, by an extension, a thief's flight from camp was interpreted as subversion of the camp system, rather than as a dash to freedom. Such was the last rib of the fan of Article 58, a fan whose spread encompassed all human existence. Now that we have completed our review of this great article of the Criminal Code, we are less likely to be astounded further on. Wherever the law is, crime can be found. The Damascene steel of Article 58, first tried out in 1927, right after it was forged, was wetted by all the waves of the following decade, and with whistle and slash was used to the full to deal telling blows in the law's attack upon the people in 1937 to 1938. Here one has to make the point that the 1937 operation was not arbitrary or accidental, but well planned, well ahead of time, and that in the first half of that year many Soviet prisons were re-equipped. Cots were taken out of the cells and continuous one- or two-storied board benches or bunks were built. It was similarly not by chance that the big house in Leningrad was finished in 1934, just in time for Kirov's assassination. Old prisoners claim to remember that the first blow allegedly took the form of mass arrests, striking virtually throughout the whole country on one single August night. But knowing our clumsiness, I don't really believe this. In that autumn, when people were trustingly expecting a big nationwide amnesty on the 20th anniversary of the October Revolution, Stalin, the prankster, added unheard-of 15- and 20-year prison terms to the Criminal Code. The 25-year term was added for the 30th anniversary of the revolution in 1947. There is hardly any need to repeat here what has already been widely written, and will be written many times more, about 1937, that a crushing blow was dealt the upper ranks of the party, the government, the military command, and the GPU-NKVD itself. These days, as we observe the Chinese Cultural Revolution at the same stage, in the 17th year after its final victory, we can begin to consider it very likely that there exists a fundamental law of historical development, and even Stalin himself begins to seem only a blind and perfunctory executive agent. There was hardly one province of the Soviet Union in which the first secretary of the party committee or the chairman of the provincial executive committee survived. Stalin picked more suitable people for his purposes. Olga Chavchavadze tells how it was in Tbilisi. In 1938, the chairman of the city executive committee, his first deputy, department chiefs, their assistants, all the chief accountants, all the chief economists were arrested. New ones were appointed in their places. 2 months passed, and the arrest began again. The chairman, the deputy, all 11 department chiefs, all the chief accountants, all the chief economists. The only people left at liberty were ordinary accountants, stenographers, charwomen, and messengers. In the arrest of rank-and-file members of the party, there was evidently a hidden theme not directly stated anywhere in the indictments and verdicts, that arrests should be carried out predominantly among party members who had joined before 1924. This was pursued with particular rigor in Leningrad, because all of them there had signed the platform of the new opposition. And how could they have refused to sign? How could they have refused to trust their Leningrad Provincial Party Committee? Here is one vignette from those years as it actually occurred. A district party conference was underway in Moscow province. It was presided over by a new secretary of the district party committee, replacing one recently arrested. At the conclusion of the conference, a tribute to Comrade Stalin was called for. Of course, everyone stood up, just as everyone had leapt to his feet during the conference at every mention of his name. The small hall echoed with stormy applause rising to an ovation. For 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, the stormy applause rising to an ovation continued. But palms were getting sore, and raised arms were already aching, and the older people were panting from exhaustion. It was becoming insufferably silly even to those who really adored Stalin. However, who would dare be the first to stop? The secretary of the district party committee could have done it. He was standing on the platform, and it was he who had just called for the ovation. But he was a newcomer. He had taken the place of a man who had been arrested. He was afraid. After all, NKVD men were standing in the hall applauding and watching to see who quit first. And in that obscure, small hall unknown to the leader, the applause went on 6, 7, 8 minutes. They were done for. Their goose was cooked. They couldn't stop now till they collapsed with heart attacks. At the rear of the hall, which was crowded, they could, of course, cheat a bit, clap less frequently, less vigorously, not so eagerly. But up there with the presidium where everyone could see them, the director of the local paper factory, an independent and strong-minded man, stood with the presidium. Aware of all the falsity and all the impossibility of the situation, he still kept on applauding. 9 minutes. 10. In anguish, he watched the secretary of the district party committee, but the latter dared not stop. Insanity. To the last man. With make-believe enthusiasm on their faces, looking at each other with faint hope, the district leaders were just going to go on and on applauding till they fell where they stood, till they were carried out of the hall on stretchers, and even then those who were left would not falter. Then, after 11 minutes, the director of the paper factory assumed a business-like expression and sat down in his seat. And oh, a miracle took place. Where had the universal, uninhibited, indescribable enthusiasm gone? To a man, everyone else stopped dead and sat down. They had been saved. The squirrel had been smart enough to jump off his revolving wheel. That, however, was how they discovered who the independent people were, and that was how they went about eliminating them. That same night, the factory director was arrested. They easily pasted 10 years on him on the pretext of something quite different. But after he had signed Form 206, the final document of the interrogation, his interrogator reminded him, "Don't ever be the first to stop applauding." Told to me by N. G. Co. And just what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to stop? Now that's what Darwin's natural selection is, and that's also how to grind people down with stupidity. But today a new myth is being created. Every story of 1937 that is printed, every reminiscence that is published, relates without exception the tragedy of the communist leaders. They have kept on assuring us, and we have unwittingly fallen for it, that the history of 1937 and 1938 consisted chiefly of the arrests of the big communists, and virtually no one else. But out of the millions arrested at that time, important party and state officials could not possibly have represented more than 10%. Most of the relatives standing in line with food parcels outside the Leningrad prisons were lower-class women, the sort who sold milk. The composition of the hordes who were arrested in that powerful wave and lugged off, half-dead, to the archipelago was of such fantastic diversity that anyone who wants to deduce the rationale for it scientifically will rack his brain a long time for the answer. To the contemporaries of the purge, it was still more incomprehensible. The real law underlying the arrests of those years was the assignment of quotas, the norms set, the planned allocations. Every city, every district, every military unit was assigned a specific quota of arrests to be carried out by a stipulated time. From then on, everything else depended on the ingenuity of the security operations personnel. The former Czechist Alexander Kalganov recalls that a telegram arrived in Tashkent.
Send 200.
They had just finished one clean-out, and it seemed as if there was no one else to take. Well, true, they had just brought in about 50 more from the districts. And then they had an idea. They would reclassify as 58 all the non-political offenders being held by the police. No sooner said than done. But despite that, they had still not filled the quota. At that precise moment, the police reported that a gypsy band had impudently encamped on one of the city squares and asked what to do with them. Someone had another bright idea. They surrounded the encampment and raked in all the gypsy men from 17 to 60 as 58s. They had fulfilled the plan. This could happen another way as well. According to Chief of Police Zabolovsky, the Czechists of Ossetia were given a quota of 500 to be shot in the Republic. They asked to have it increased, and they were permitted another 250. Telegrams transmitting instructions of this kind were sent via ordinary channels in a very rudimentary code. In Temriuk, the woman telegrapher, in holy innocence, transmitted to the NKVD switchboard the message that 240 boxes of soap were to be shipped to Krasnodar the following day. In the morning she learned about a big wave of arrests and guessed the meaning of the message. She told her girlfriend what kind of telegram it was, and was promptly arrested herself. Was it indeed totally by chance that the code words for human beings were a box of soap, or were they familiar with soap making? Of course, certain patterns could be discerned. Among those arrested were our own real spies abroad. These were often the most dedicated Comintern workers and Czechists, and among them were many attractive women. They were called back to the motherland and arrested at the border. They were then confronted with their former Comintern chief, for example, Mirov Korona, who confirmed that he himself had been working for one of the foreign intelligence services, which meant that his subordinates were automatically guilty too. And the more dedicated they were, the worse it was for them. Soviet employees of the Chinese Eastern Railroad, the KVZHD, were one and all arrested as Japanese spies, including their wives, children, and grandmothers. But we have to admit these arrests had already begun several years earlier. Koreans from the Far East were sent into exile in Kazakhstan, the first experiment in mass arrests on the basis of race. Leningrad Estonians were all arrested on the strength of having Estonian family names, and charged with being anti-communist Estonian spies. All Latvian riflemen and all Latvian Czechists were arrested. Yes, indeed, there's many Latvians who had been the midwives of the revolution, who, just a short while before, had constituted the nucleus and the pride of the Cheka. And with them were taken even those communists of bourgeois Latvia who had been exchanged in 1921 and been freed thereby from their dreadful Latvian prison terms of 2 and 3 years. In Leningrad, the Latvian department of the Herzen Institute, the House of Latvian Culture, the Estonian Club, the Latvian Technicum, and the Latvian and Estonian newspapers were all closed down. In the midst of the general to-do, the big solitaire game was finally wound up. All those not yet taken were raked in. There was no longer any reason to keep it secret. The time had come to write finis to the whole game. So now the socialists were taken off to prison in whole exiles, for example the Ufa exile and the Saratov exile, and they were all sentenced together and driven off in herds to the slaughterhouses of the archipelago. Nowhere was it specifically prescribed that more members of the intelligentsia should be arrested than of other groups, but just as the intelligentsia had never been overlooked in previous waves, it was not neglected in this one. A student's denunciation, and this combination of words, student and denunciation, had ceased to sound outlandish. That a certain lecturer in a higher educational institution kept citing Lenin and Marx frequently, but Stalin not at all, was all that was needed for the lecturer not to show up for lectures any more. And what if he cited no one? All Leningrad Orientalists of the middle and younger generation were arrested. The entire staff of the Institute of the North, except for its NKVD informers, was arrested. They even went after schoolteachers. In Sverdlovsk, one case involved 30 secondary schoolteachers and the head of the provincial education department, Perel. 5 of them died before trial from tortures suffered during interrogation. 24 died in camps. The 30th, Ivan Aristalovich Punich, returned after his release and rehabilitation. Had he died, we would have known nothing about the 30, just as we know nothing about millions of others. And the many witnesses who testified against them are still there in Sverdlovsk today, prospering, occupying responsible positions, or living on as special pensioners. Darwinian selection. One of the terrible accusations against them was that they had made arrangements to have a New Year's tree in order to burn down the school. And the club fell with the regularity of a pendulum on the heads of the engineers, who by this time were no longer bourgeois, but a whole Soviet generation of engineers. Because of an irregularity in the geological strata, 2 mine tunnels which mine surveyor Nikolai Merkuryevich Mikov had calculated would meet, failed to do so. He got Article 58, 7, 20 years. 6 geologists, the Kotovich group, were sentenced to 10 years under 58, 7, for intentionally concealing reserves of tin ore in underground sites in anticipation of the arrival of the Germans. In other words, they had failed to find the deposits. On the heels of the main waves followed an additional, special wave of wives and the so-called CHS, members of families. Among them were the wives of important party leaders and also, in certain places, Leningrad, for example, the wives of all those who had been sentenced to 10 years without the right to correspond, in other words, those who were no longer among the living. The CHS, as a rule, all got 8 years. Well, that was still less than the dispossessed kulaks got, and their children did not go to the archipelago. Piles of victims, hills of victims, a frontal assault of the NKVD on the city. In one way, for example, G.P. Matveyeva saw not only her husband, but all 3 of her brothers arrested, and all in different cases. Of the 4, 3 never returned. An electrician had a high-tension line break in his sector. 58-7, 20 years. A perm worker, Novikov, was accused of planning to blow up a Kama River bridge. In that same city of Perm, Zhuzhakov was arrested during the day, and at night they came for his wife. They presented her with a list of names and demanded that she sign a confession that they had all met in her house at a Menshevik SR meeting. Of course, they had not. They promised in return to let her out to be with her three children. She signed, destroying all those listed, and of course she herself remained in prison. Nadezhda Yudenich was arrested because of her family name. True, they established after 9 months that she was not related to the white general, and they let her out. A mere trifle. During that time, her mother had died of worry. The film Lenin in October was shown in Staraya Russa. Someone present noticed the phrase in the film, Palchinsky must know. Palchinsky was defending the Winter Palace. But we have a nurse working here named Palchinskaya. Arrest her. They did arrest her, and it turned out that she actually was his wife, who had hidden in the provinces following his execution. In 1930, as small boys, the three brothers, Pavel, Ivan, and Stepan Boruszko, came to the Soviet Union from Poland to live with their parents. Now, as young men, they were arrested for PSH, suspicion of espionage, and got 10 years. A streetcar motorwoman of Krasnodar was returning on foot late at night from the car depot. On the outskirts of the city, to her misfortune, she passed some people working to free a truck that had gotten stuck. It turned out to be full of corpses, hands and legs stuck out from beneath the canvas. They wrote down her name, and the next day she was arrested. The interrogator asked her what she had seen. She told him truthfully. Darwinian selection. Anti-Soviet agitation, 10 years. A plumber turned off the loudspeaker in his room every time the endless letters to Stalin were being read. Who remembers them? They went on and on every day for hours, stupefyingly identical. Levitan, the announcer, probably remembers them well. He used to read them in rolling tones, with great expression. His next-door neighbor denounced him. Where, oh where, is that neighbor today? He got SOE, socially dangerous element, 8 years. A half-literate stove-maker used to enjoy writing his name in his free time. This raised his self-esteem. There was no blank paper around, so he wrote on newspapers. His neighbors found his newspaper in the sack in the communal toilet, with pen and ink flourishes across the countenance of the father and teacher. Anti-Soviet agitation, 10 years. Stalin and those close to him loved their portraits and splashed them all over the newspapers and issued them in millions of copies. The flies paid little heed to their sanctity, and it was a pity not to make use of the paper. And how many unfortunates got a term for that? Arrests rolled through the streets and department houses like an epidemic. Just as people transmit an epidemic infection from one to another without knowing it, by such innocent means as a handshake, a breath, handing someone something, so too they passed on the infection of inevitable arrest by a handshake, by a breath, by a chance meeting on the street. For if you are destined to confess tomorrow that you organized an underground group to poison the city's water supply, and if today I shake hands with you on the street, that means I, too, am doomed. 7 years earlier, the city had watched while they massacred the countryside and considered it only natural. Now the countryside might have watched them massacre the city, but the countryside itself was too dark for that and was still undergoing the finishing touches of its own slaughter. The surveyor, Sornin, got 15 years for cattle plague in the district and for bad harvests, and the entire leadership of the district was shot for the same reason. The secretary of a district party committee went into the fields to speed up the ploughing, and an old peasant asked him whether he knew that for 7 years the collective farmers had received not one single ounce of grain in return for their labour days, only straw, and very little of that. For his question, the peasant got ASA, anti-Soviet agitation, 10 years. Another peasant with 6 children met a different fate. Because he had 6 mouths to feed, he devoted himself wholeheartedly to collective farm work, and kept hoping he would get some return for his labour. And he did. They awarded him a decoration. They awarded it at a special assembly, made speeches. In his reply, the peasant got carried away. He said, "Now, if I could just have a sack of flour instead of this decoration, couldn't I, somehow?" A wolf-like laugh rocketed through the hall, and the newly decorated hero went off to exile, together with all six of those dependent mouths. Should we wrap it all up and simply say that there rested the innocent? But we omitted saying that the very concept of guilt had been repealed by the proletarian revolution, and at the beginning of the 30s was defined as rightist opportunism. So we can't even discuss these out-of-date concepts, guilt and innocence. The reverse wave of 1939 was an unheard-of incident in the history of the organs, a blot on their record. But in fact, this reverse wave was not large. It included about 1 to 2% of those who had been arrested but not yet convicted, who had not yet been sent away to far-off places and had not yet perished. It was not large, but it was put to effective use. It was like giving back 1 kopeck change from a ruble. But it was necessary in order to heap all the blame on that dirty Yezhov, to strengthen the newcomer, Beria, and to cause the leader himself to shine more brightly. With this kopeck, they skillfully drove the ruble right into the ground. After all, if they had sorted things out and freed some people, and even the newspapers wrote intrepidly about individual cases of persons who had been slandered, it meant that the rest of those arrested were indeed scoundrels, and those who returned kept silent. They had signed pledges not to speak out. They were mute with terror. And there were very few who knew even a little about the secrets of the archipelago. The distinction was as before, black mariahs at night and demonstrations by day. But for that matter, they soon took that kopeck back, during those same years and via those same sections of the boundless Article 58. Well, who in 1940 noticed the wave of wives arrested for failure to renounce their husbands? And who in Tambov remembers that during that year of peace, they arrested an entire jazz orchestra playing at the Modern Cinema Theatre because they all turned out to be enemies of the people? And who noticed the 30,000 Czechs who in 1939 fled from occupied Czechoslovakia to their Slavic kinfolk in the USSR? It was impossible to guarantee that a single one of them was not a spy. They sent them all off to northern camps. And it was out of those camps that the Czechoslovak Corps materialized during the war. And was it not, indeed, in 1939 that we reached out our helping hands to the West Ukrainians and the West Bielorussians, and in 1940 to the Baltic states and the Moldavians? It turned out that our brothers badly needed to be purged, and from them, too, flowed waves of social prophylaxis. They took those who were too independent, too influential, along with those who were too well-to-do, too intelligent, too noteworthy. They took particularly many Poles from former Polish provinces. It was then that ill-fated Katyn was filled up, and then, too, that in the northern camps they stockpiled fodder for the future army of Sikorsky and Anders. They arrested officers everywhere. Thus the population was shaken up, forced into silence, and left without any possible leaders of resistance. Thus it was that wisdom was instilled, that former ties and former friendships were cut off. Finland ceded its isthmus to us with zero population. Nevertheless, the removal and resettlement of all persons with Finnish blood took place throughout Soviet Karelia and in Leningrad in 1940. We didn't notice that wavelet. We have no Finnish blood. In the Finnish War, we undertook our first experiment in convicting our war prisoners as traitors to the motherland, the first such experiment in human history. And would you believe it? We didn't notice. That was the rehearsal. Just at that moment, the war burst upon us, and with it, a massive retreat. It was essential to evacuate swiftly everyone who could be got out of the Western republics that were being abandoned to the enemy. In the rush, entire military units, regiments, anti-aircraft and artillery batteries were left behind intact in Lithuania. But they still managed to get out several thousand families of unreliable Lithuanians. 4,000 of them were subsequently turned over to be plundered by thieves in camp at Krasnoyarsk. From June the 23rd on, in Latvia and Estonia, they speeded up the arrests. But the ground was burning under them, and they were forced to leave even faster. They forgot to take whole fortresses with them, like the one at Brest. But they did not forget to shoot down political prisoners in the cells and courtyards of Lvov, Rovno, Tallinn, and many other Western prisons. In the Tartu prison, they shot 192 prisoners and threw their corpses down a well. How can one visualize it? You know nothing. The door of your cell opens, and they shoot you. You cry out in your death agony, and there is no one to hear your cries or tell of them except the prison stones. They say, however, that there were some who weren't successfully finished off, and we may some day read a book about that, too. In the rear, the first wartime wave was for those spreading rumors and panic. That was the language of a special decree outside the code issued in the first days of the war. I myself almost felt the impact of that decree. I was standing in line at the bread store when a policeman called me out and took me off for the sake of his score. If it had not been for a fortunate intervention, I might have started out in Gulag right away instead of going off to war. This was just a trial bloodletting in order to maintain a general state of tension. They gave everyone 10 years for it, but it was not considered part of Article 58, and therefore those few who survived the wartime camps were amnested in 1945. Then there was a wave of those who failed to turn in radio receivers or radio parts. For one radio tube found, as a result of denunciation, they gave 10 years. Then there was the wave of Germans living on the Volga, colonists in the Ukraine and the North Caucasus, and all Germans in general who lived anywhere in the Soviet Union. The determining factor here was blood, and even heroes of the Civil War and old members of the party who were German were sent off into exile. They judged blood by family name. The design engineer, Vasily Okorokov, had found it inconvenient to sign his drawings with his real name. Consequently, in the 30s, when it was still legally possible, he had changed his name to Robert Stecker. It was elegant, and he was able to work up a good-looking professional signature with it. Now he was arrested as a German, and given no chance to prove he was not. So he was exiled. "Is this your real name? What assignment were you given by the Fascist Intelligence Service?" Then there was that native of Tambov whose real name was Kaverdzhenev, and who changed it to Kolba in 1918. At what point did he share Okorokov's fate? In essence, the exile of the Germans was similar to the dispossession of the kulaks, but it was less harsh, since the Germans were allowed to take more of their possessions with them and were not sent off to such fatal, deadly areas. As had been the case with the kulaks, the German exile had no juridical basis. The criminal code in itself was one thing, and the exile of hundreds of thousands of people was something else entirely. It was the personal edict of a monarch. In addition, this was his first experiment of the sort with an entire nationality, and he found it extremely interesting from a theoretical point of view. By the end of the summer of 1941, becoming bigger in the autumn, the wave of the encircled was surging in. These were the defenders of their native land, the very same warriors whom the cities had seen off to the front with bouquets and bands a few months before, who had then sustained the heaviest tank assaults of the Germans, and in the general chaos, and through no fault of their own, had spent a certain time as isolated units, not in enemy imprisonment, not at all, but in temporary encirclement, and later had broken out. And instead of being given a brotherly embrace on their return, such as every other army in the world would have given them, instead of being given a chance to rest up, to visit their families, and then return to their units, they were held on suspicion, disarmed, deprived of all rights, and taken away in groups to identification points and screening centers, where officers of the special branches started interrogating them, distrusting not only their every word, but their very identity. Identification consisted of cross-questioning, confrontations, pitting the evidence of one against another. Afterward, Some of those who had been encircled were restored to their former names, ranks, and responsibilities, and went off to military units. Others, fewer in number at the start, constituted the first wave of traitors of the motherland under 58.1b. But at first, until the standard penalty was finally determined, they got less than 10 years. That was how the active army was kept purge. But there was also an enormous inactive army in the Far East and in Mongolia, and it was the noble task of the special branches to keep that army from growing rusty. And, for lack of anything to do, the heroes of Khalkhin Gol and Khazan began to let their tongues wag, especially after they were permitted to examine the DegTRF automatic pistols and the regimental mortars, which until then had been kept secret even from Soviet soldiers. With such weapons in their hands, it was hard for them to understand why we were retreating in the West. With all Siberia and the Urals between them and European Russia, it was not easy for them to grasp that in retreating 70 miles a day, we were simply repeating the Kutuzov entrapment maneuver. Their comprehension could be helped along only by means of a wave from the Eastern Army, and at that point lips tightened and faith became steely. It was obvious that a wave had also to roll in high places, of those to blame for the retreat. After all, it was not the great strategist who was at fault. It was a small wave, just 50 men, a general's wave. They were in Moscow prisons by the summer of 1941, and in October 1941 they were sent off on a prisoner transport. Most of the generals were from the Air Force. Among them were Air Force Commander Smushkevich and General Ptukhin, who was known to have said, "If I had known, I would have first bombed our dear father and then gone off to prison." And there were others. The victory outside Moscow gave rise to a new wave, guilty Muscovites. Looking at things after the event, it turned out that these Muscovites, who had not run away and who had not been evacuated, but had fearlessly remained in the threatened capital, which had been abandoned by the authorities, were by that very token under suspicion either of subverting governmental authority, 58.10, or of staying on to await the Germans, 58.1a via 19, a wave which kept on providing fodder for the interrogators of Moscow and Leningrad right up to 1945. It need hardly be said that 58.10, ASA, anti-Soviet agitation, never let up, but hovered over the front and in the rear throughout the war. Sentences under 58.10 were handed out to evacuees who talked about the horrors of the retreat. It was clear from the newspapers that the retreat was proceeding according to plan. To those in the rear who were guilty of the slanderous rumour that rations were meagre. To those at the front who were guilty of the slanderous rumour that the Germans had excellent equipment. And to those everywhere who in 1942 were guilty of the slanderous rumour that people were dying of starvation in blockaded Leningrad. During that same year, after the disasters at Kerch, 120,000 prisoners, at Kharkov, even more, and in the course of the big southern retreat to the Caucasus and the Volga, another very important wave of officers and soldiers was pumped through, those who refused to stand their death, and who retreated without permission. The men whom, in the words of Stalin's immortal order number 227, the motherland could not forgive for the shame they had caused her. This wave, however, never reached Gulag. After accelerated processing by divisional tribunals, it was, to a man, herded into punishment battalions and was soaked up in the red sand of advanced positions, leaving not a trace. Thus was cemented the foundation of the Stalingrad victory. But it has found no place in the usual Russian history, and exists only in the private history of the sewage system. Incidentally, we are here trying to identify only those waves which came into Gulag from outside. There was, after all, an incessant internal recirculation from reservoir to reservoir through the system of so-called sentencing in camp, which was particularly rampant during the war years. But we are not considering those in this chapter. Conscientiousness requires that we recall also the reverse waves of wartime, the previously mentioned Czechs and Poles who were released, as well as criminals released for service at the front. From 1943 on, when the war turned in our favour, there began the multi-million wave from the occupied territories and from Europe, which got larger every year up to 1946. Its two main divisions were civilians who had lived under the Germans or among Germans, hung with a tenor under the letter A, 58-1A, military personnel who had been POWs, who were nailed with a tenor under the letter B, 58-1B. Everyone living under the occupation wanted, of course, to survive, and therefore could not remain with hands folded, and thereby theoretically earned, along with his daily bread, a future sentence, if not for treason to the motherland, then at least for aiding and abetting the enemy. However, in actual practice, it was enough to note in the passport serial number that a person had been in occupied territory. To arrest all such persons would have been, from the economic point of view, irrational, because it would have depopulated such enormous areas. All that was required in order to heighten the general consciousness was to arrest a certain percentage of those guilty, those